Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Today I'm joined by the historian Tom Holland. We are going to discuss how the global lockdown during the pandemic has been prefigured in literature, history, and popular culture. Are we all now living in a horror film? So Tom, you've written a wonderful essay for us on Engelsberg Ideas, on how fiction in many ways has framed the way we interpret this pandemic, and how early on during the UK lockdown, when the streets of London suddenly were empty, it felt like something out of a movie. I mean, most of us hasn't lived through this situation before, but it's strangely familiar. And I just wonder if this is an example of that general principle of Oscar Wilde, that life imitates art far more than art imitates life.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that it wasn't just me. I think almost everyone I spoke to when the lockdown, actually even before the lockdown began, when coronavirus was a kind of distant rumour, and then you'd see photographs of people panicking in distant cities and then starting to wear masks and then taking temperatures and then images of airports closing down. And then the sense of it coming closer and closer and closer. And it was eerily reminiscent of horror films. Contagion, I suppose, is the classic example, which is actually about the outbreak of a pandemic. But there have been so many films that revolve around the idea of some terrible disease, some pandemic, some transformational effect rippling outwards and then engulfing the familiar and turning the familiar into the strange. And the film that haunted me was Danny Boyle's film, zombie film, 28 Days Later, which opens with a man who's been in intensive care in St. Thomas's Hospital, much like Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, was. And he wakes up 28 days after this terrible event has happened that has unleashed a kind of turned everyone in Britain into flesh-eating zombies. And he walks out onto Westminster Bridge and it's completely empty. The idea for this essay came from the fact that my wife and I, for our exercise, we've been doing enormously long walks all over London. And we went to Westminster Bridge on Easter morning, very early for sunrise. And that was the day when Johnson was still in hospital. The lockdown, I think, had been in effect for a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And we stood on Westminster Bridge and it looked exactly as the opening of 28 Days Later looked. It struck me that you're right, of course, that when we look at the vistas of famous cities emptied of people, we have the images that come from disaster films, from apocalyptic films, from zombie films in our heads. But at the same time, what interested me was why, before the pandemic had hit, why were people making these films? What's the fascination of it? So I think it is actually kind of mutually reinforcing.
Yeah.
Film directors, novelists, poets, whoever, have anticipated what is now happening. But the reason why they've anticipated, I mean, that's part of the story, I think.
Why have they anticipated this? Is it very deep within us, or?
I think in the context of the scale and the speed of this particular pandemic, I think it's evident that it has arisen for reasons to do with industrialization, to do with globalization. It's about human beings pushing into ecosystems that previously had been intact and thereby rendering themselves open to all kinds of viruses and pathogens that previously would have come nowhere near human beings. And that then combines with the fact that the world is incredibly interconnected and something that happens in Wuhan can be in London or New York within a day. And I think that particularly the rise of zombie films, but also I think also Planet of the Apes, the recent version of it, which likewise consisted of an outbreak of a disease that had transferred, zoonotic, that had transferred from an animal into humans. And the end of the film, you see it spreading around the globe. That these are speaking of deep-seated anxieties about what might happen that in the event did happen. Because, of course, what everybody has been saying about coronavirus is that this was an accident waiting to happen, and so it has come to pass.
But isn't also pandemics, I mean, if there's something that's really part of history, it's pandemics. It happens regularly throughout history. That's also maybe why it's so indebted in our imagination.
Yes, because the other thing, of course, that a zombie film very powerfully expresses as a thing of terror is the dread of infection. A zombie is dehumanized.
Mm.
So therefore they become acceptable vectors for our sense of anxiety about infection.
Mm.
Obviously, the whole thing about the response to coronavirus is that we have to tend to the sick, and hospitals exist to tend to the sick. Health workers are there to tend to the sick. The whole of society is in lockdown to ensure that the sick recover. So there is, oddly, a kind of liberating effect in regarding the infected as terrible enemies to be escaped from. And that's also what 28 Days Later expresses, is it's a kind of instinctive reaction when confronted with infection, is actually that you run away. And that also is something that you see throughout the history of responses to pandemics. So whenever there's been, particularly great cities have been hit, the sense that urban centres are particularly dangerous has always fostered a kind of impulse to run to the hills. So the most famous fictional treatment of that is Boccaccio's Decameron, which was written in the immediate aftermath of the onset of the Black Death, and describes 10 lords and ladies fleeing Florence and setting up in a secluded spot outside the city and tell each other stories. But this is a kind of inherent reaction and a kind of given throughout history. And so I think that part of the fascination of watching fictional treatments of this on not just films, of course, but also on computer games, where, you know, it's a very kind of popular subgenre that you're being attacked by zombies and you have to shoot them and kill them. It's kind of, well, I think a Freudian would have a field day with it. I think it's a kind of expression of sublimated resentment against the infected. I think that is a kind of huge unspoken undercurrent of what's happening at the moment.
But it's interesting that you said it. So if fiction frames our way of thinking around the crisis, it's also interesting to note that history is back with a vengeance as a source of inspiration and guidance in how to handle this ongoing crisis. I mean, I've never seen so many newspaper articles actually applying history, drawing parallels between everything from, you know, the plague in 17th century Florence to, of course, the Spanish flu of 1918.
Yes, and I think that what's been interesting about that, and it is a great thing for someone who's not, you know, not into STEM, is that actually history has played perhaps the key role in the approach to handling the pandemic, because for all the modelling and all the most up-to-date input of epidemiologists, the most effective response to this virus turns out to derive from the way that American cities and the Spanish flu responded. And it's a comparative study of, did you lock down early? Did you lock down late? Did you open up the lockdown too early? Did you not? And the impact that this had. And that really is what has guided the most successful approaches to this. I'm English, you're Swedish. We sort of bucked the trend.
Yes.
So, and did so on the most expert epidemiological advice. You know, and it may well turn out that that advice turns out to be right. But as it stands at the moment, it seems that the most effective response, the most effective way of dealing with this is a response that is basically certainly as old as the Spanish flu. I mean, in fact, much older than that. The whole idea of the quarantine goes back to Venice. You know, it's even older than that in many ways. And again, that also was part of what I was interested in these walks, was that London has always been a city visited by plague over the course of its history. So the plague of 1665 is seared into the collective memory of the city, the fact that the Great Fire followed afterwards. And London is a city where disaster is kind of written into the stones and the fabric and the things that we tell each other. But again, it's also about the fictions that have been fashioned out of the contemplation of this city. The essay is structured around three walks. The first one is a walk to Westminster Bridge around a city that appears empty. The second one is a walk to Primrose Hill from Putney. And that follows in the footsteps of the narrator of H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds, which, of course, describes a Martian invasion in which humans are swept out of London and then end up being wiped out by bacteria, not by a virus, but by bacteria. And that, of course, essentially is about the Swedish and what was initially the British response, which is about herd immunity. Yes. Because the reason that the Martians get wiped out is that they don't have the herd immunity that humans over, you know, the course of millennia have built up. So again, I thought it's kind of perfect mirror to hold up.
There's also, in Wells' case, it's actually the virus sort of saves humanity rather than...
Yes, and that, of course, is a further refinement. And again, you know, pushing through into what is a very distinctively 21st century perspective, there is this argument that has appeared on social media. You get it on the kind of more radical fringes of Extinction Rebellion and other ecological movements, that actually humans are the virus.
Yeah.
But actually, if you look at it in the context of H.G. Wells's novel, actually that, you know, humans turn out to be the Martians. We're being wiped out to protect the planet. This is the, you know, and I think that that also will be a part of the kind of churn of cultural responses that emerge from this. It will weaponize that perspective on humans and its relationship to the planet, one in which we are seen as part of the problem, really.
At the same time, going back to sort of, you know, last year's debates and a couple of years going through is on environment, it's been this message that we should trust the science. But of course, what is happening right now is actually we've been forced to recognize there is not such a thing as the one science. So all countries, I mean, will say that they are led by science and guided by science, but their conclusions are not the same. They will do different things. Some might be because of regional differences, but others are obviously because they interpret the science differently.
Absolutely. And I think one of the revelations of this crisis has been the degree to which scientists, of course, are just as prone to disagreeing and indeed sleeping with each other and misbehaving as politicians. And it's been remarkable to see how they've become celebrities. I mean, I think in Sweden, the relative hotness of your epidemiologists has become a crucial part of public discourse. And it's evident that this kind of fascination with the personality of scientists reflects the fact that there are huge issues at stake and that they don't agree. The available data can be interpreted in radically different ways. And that then, obviously, for the politicians is a real problem because, you know, if you're a humble arts graduate or something and you're suddenly being given different models and the whole future of the country depends on it. I mean, it's a hugely difficult situation to be in.
One thing I've been wondering about is basically it's hard to form policy out of science and when the science is ongoing. I mean, there's one thing when you know what actually you've seen it many times before. Well, this is where history actually comes in, because at least we can draw some conclusions. We've been in similar situations before, even though they're not perfectly comparable. And it's also coming back to why it's suddenly such a demand for historical analysis. What role should history play in policymaking, you think?
One of the paradoxes of this is that it's been the countries that have the broadest range of epidemiology, the largest battery of experts, the broadest array of opinion, that in many ways have done worse. So the United States, UK, France, all countries that are well known for having an incredibly rich medical culture. The countries that have done best are those that don't have that, that essentially have had to rely on, let's call them medieval approaches. You know, we're just locked down. So you look at a country like Greece, which has been hollowed out by austerity, you know, has a very fragile health system. They just went into lockdown because they knew they couldn't afford to. They couldn't afford to experiment with the new approaches. They couldn't afford to rely on the new modelling. They had to go for what they knew would work, and they knew it would work because they could look back through the course of history. And it's quite kind of humbling, I think, for those in countries who are accustomed to think that they stand at the cutting edge of medical research and medical knowledge to realise that actually, in this case, you know, oldest is best. Mm. It's kind of like discovering suddenly that trepanning is much better than brain surgery.
But, you know, in academic circles, using history in this way and learning from history in a very sort of straightforward manner and practical way is viewed with suspicion. Why do you think that is?
Because every circumstance in the present is different, of course, and it can be difficult to apply things that happened in the past to the present day. Because again, to go back to the idea of science fiction, if you push that too far, you arrive at the situation that Isaac Asimov treats in Foundation, where he has this idea that, you know, a vast galactic empire is falling to pieces, and there's a guy who can see this because he's crunched the data and he can examine human affairs and treat it as though it's a law, and so he can work out exactly what the future is going to hold. We're nowhere near that. I mean, there was also the theme of Alex Garland's recent science fiction series, Devs, which was on TV, again, had kind of very similar idea. These are fantasies. I think the value of history for policymakers, rather than kind of looking back and saying, well, this happened, therefore we should copy that. Although I think that the lockdown is an exception to that. I think the lockdown is kind of the exception that proves the rule. I think that what is more interesting is to look back at history and say, well, why do we think the way that we do? Mm. It provides scope for interrogating the basis of what we take for granted. The risk, I think, for policymakers is that their assumptions, their prejudices may be equated with the way things are, with human nature or whatever. That's why it's always good to ask, well, is what I think is human nature, is it in fact just culturally contingent? And I think that as Western power retreats, as different countries rise to superpower status or great power status that have very different cultural traditions to those of the West, I think that's going to become more and more important. And again, you can see this is evident in the way that the different responses that you get in different parts of the world to the pandemic, again, they're not governed solely by science. They're governed by cultural approaches to crisis, to the way that society is organized, to the obligations that the government has to its people, to the obligation that, people have to their own fellow citizens, that these are all culturally variable. And so that, I think, is the real value of history, because if you look at your own area, your own country, your own civilizational grouping, and then you work out from that, that what happens, say, in China is not necessarily going to approximate to what's going to happen in Italy.
Your latest book, Dominion, discusses the Western mind and our Western culture by describing and discussing the history of Christianity. So is there a Western answer to this, pandemic that is rooted in Christianity, you would say?
Absolutely. I think it's very clear that, I mean, in fact, in the essay I've written for you, I cite the words, I don't quote him, but I cite the words of a bishop of Alexandria who records how the reaction of people in Alexandria is to flee the city and to just abandon it and to take no care for those who can't afford to flee or who are too sick to flee. And this is serving a polemical purpose because, of course, what the bishop is drawing attention to is the fact that Christians are not doing this. And Christians are not doing this partly because they have a reliance on the fact that there is a more beautiful life awaiting them. So death, therefore, is a liberation. Mm. So it has ceased to be the thing of fear that it might be to non-Christians. But also because the obligation on a Christian is to care for those who are sick, those who are suffering, because that's the obligation that's laid on them by Christ. And so that results, in a sense, over the course of the third century, when the Roman Empire is ravaged by terrible, terrible pandemics, kind of some seem to be coming from the hinterlands of Central Asia, some from the hinterlands of Africa, these two great kind of breeding grounds for pandemics. Over the course of the third century, Christians construct what we might call a proto-welfare state. The idea that the church, the ecclesia, the assembly of Christian people have a duty of care to the sick, even if they themselves are not sick. And actually, in many cases, in many cities, not just to Christians, but to everybody. So in the middle of the third century AD, Cyprian's plague, it's called after the bishop of Carthage, Cyprian, who writes about it. That's a kind of Ebola that seems to have raged across the entire empire for something like 12 years. And the measure of its impact essentially is that no one can bring themselves to write about it. It's clearly such a terrifying, monstrous experience. We've almost forgotten about it. And yet it seems that it's in that period that Christianity really puts down the foundations that over the course of the following century with Constantine and so on will enable it to establish itself as the kind of the great structure that forms the whole empire. And the reason for this, I think, is that this model of a welfare state, this model of cities in which the healthy feel that they have a responsibility to the sick is something that people remember with gratitude and therefore are more prone to becoming Christian themselves. But also in the long run, that it serves the cause of public health better, because if you're setting up hospitals, if you're washing people, if you're cleaning them, if you're feeding them, actually in the long run, they are then likelier to survive. And this establishes a tradition of public health that outlives the Roman Empire, runs into the Middle Ages, that runs through the early modern period. And in a sense, the welfare states that we have in the West today, with their government-funded, health, publicly funded health systems, hospitals, medical staff, these are nationalized versions of the Christian model of public health that ultimately goes all the way back to the third century, which is a pretty stupefying thought. And so I think it's valuable to recognize how culturally contingent this tradition is and what it is about it that has worked, and also perhaps what hasn't.
Why is Christianity, the Christian message, so revolutionary at the time? Because the way you describe it is basically this is changes everything. It's a before and after, and then it molds a Western mind. I don't know if it's a new Western mind, but it's something new happens. What is so revolutionary in the message at the time?
Well, it's important, to make the obvious point that nothing comes from nothing. So Christianity doesn't just spontaneously emerge. So it's a fusion. I mean, it's a fusion of all kinds of Persian, obviously, of Jewish, of Greek, of Roman elements. You know, if you think of a gin and tonic, gin and tonic together, you know, they're the constituent elements, but you put them together and you've got something quite new. And I think that effectively is the role that Christianity plays in the history of antiquity. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like a virus, actually. It's something that emerges out of a globalized society. It emerges in the context of cities that are bringing different people, different traditions, mixing them together. And then they're able to spread because there are shipping lanes and roads and all kinds of things. So there are elements of it that are familiar, elements of it that are kind of radically different. But I think that what makes it distinctive is that it combines two particularly potent notions, both of which have foreshadowings in both Greek and Jewish culture, but attain a peculiarly potent form in Christianity. The first of these is an idea that's kind of implicit in Genesis, where God creates all human beings in his image. The idea that all humans are created equally, have an equal dignity. And there are elements of that also in the Stoic Greek tradition. Christianity, by saying Christ has died for all of you, so that there is no man or woman, no Greek or Jew, no slave or free, all are one in Christ. This is an intellectually and emotionally, a psychologically satisfying idea in a globalized world, but it's one that's given a kind of massive mythic resonance by the inherent power of the Christian story. So that's what makes it spread. It lets people know that they have a dignity that they had not previously felt that they had. And you can see the immediate appeal of that. The other, which is kind of linked to that, and again to the kind of mythic potency of the Christian story, is the idea that the weak can triumph over the strong. And that's embodied in the central image of Christianity, the cross, which to the Romans is a symbol of their power, of their right to torture to death anyone who opposes them, be they rebels in obscure provinces or be they slaves rising up against their masters. Christianity makes of this symbol of torture a symbol of hope and a symbol of the prospect that the weak can prevail over the strong. And again, in a world where most people are weak, where most people don't have power, again, you can absolutely see the fascination of that. Those two ideas, the idea that the weak have a particular value, perhaps that they are closer to God than the strong, and the idea that all human beings, without exception, have an equal dignity. These are ideas that mutate, evolve, take on different forms, but are still self-evidently part of the fabric of what it is to be Western to this day. So much so, I think, people in the West tend not to appreciate quite how odd these ideas are.
But you also make a point that it's extraordinarily radical to start with, and then, of course, it becomes, well, sort of Romanized and maybe much palatable for more people. It's a very radical notion to begin with. Then you find ways of just making it easier to incorporate into society. Am I right there?
Well, in a sense, Western civilization is like San Francisco, built on the San Andreas Fault. You know, you can build your city, but you know that at some point, you know, the big one is going to come and it's all going to be shaken. Because there's a kind of radicalism at the heart of the Christian message, which never goes away. It's taken a kind of particularly distinctive form, not just in Christian civilization generally, but in Latin, you know, the Western form of Christianity, where the idea of what people in the 11th century call reformatio, the idea that not just the individual sinner, but the whole of society can be refashioned in a way that is pleasing to God.
Yeah,
that this is capable of generating incredibly revolutionary forces. And in a sense, it's the measure of how successful the process of reformatio in the 11th century was that people have tended to forget about it. The central idea in the 11th century is the idea that it's possible to separate the dimension of the saeculum, which is a Latin word that basically means the span of human memory. So it's the flux of things, things that come and go. And to separate it from the church, which is the guardian of the religio, the bond that joins humanity to the eternity of heaven. So if you want eternity, you have to go with the religiones, those who provide the religio, and you have to separate yourselves from the saeculum. And this gives to Western Europe something that no other civilization had, which is an idea of what will ultimately become the secular. That there is a kind of space that can be divorced from the dimension of what will come to be seen as religion. And in the cause of setting up this kind of radical division, you see all kinds of things that will become very familiar in subsequent centuries. So you see kings being humbled.
Mm-hmm.
The emperor is made to kneel in the snow outside the castle where the Pope is staying. You see armed warriors convinced of the potency of these teachings, attacking the enemies of the radicals who are introducing them, going abroad, crusaders, this is what they're up to. And in the long run, you see people who either are unwilling to accept this revolutionary new formulation being accused of heresy, or those who feel that it's not gone far enough, accusing the new elites of themselves being guilty of heresy, which essentially is what plays itself out over the course of the Middle Ages. And then by the 16th century, you get another enormous spasm of reformatio, what we call the Reformation. And then again in the Enlightenment, you get the same process. And what's happened into the present is that Christianity itself has become part of, you know, the San Francisco that is being demolished and knocked down. But the impulses that are powering this process of change are themselves remain deeply Christian. And that's the great paradox. There's a sense in which, you know, in the 11th century, the process which led to the idea of the saeculum being hived off has now come back to bite the church, because now the secular is like an enormous cuckoo that swamped the entire nest.
I also wonder, in this situation where we also seen sort of the limits of science, at least the limits of science in the very sort of short perspective, when you want it, just fix it straight away, and it actually takes some time and it's a laborious process. How secular are we really?
We're very secular in the sense that we assume that there are entire spaces where the dimension of the supernatural, the religious, whatever you want to call it, has no purchase. The idea that the secular is some kind of neutral space that everyone can occupy is pretty fundamental to the way that every society in the West organises itself. And to go back to what we were talking about earlier, one of the expressions of that is the idea that healthcare, for instance, should have nothing to do with the sacral. It's a responsibility of the state to provide it. It's purely about the body. There is no place really for the spiritual. And one of the things I think that's been interesting about this particular crisis is that all the churches seem to have suffered an incredible lack of self-confidence around it. Essentially, they've cast themselves as kind of deputies in the welfare state, perhaps wearing peculiar clothes, but otherwise they are there to repeat and to promulgate the health warnings that civil servants and health officials are giving. The idea that the obligation to care for the sick might in some way be rooted in profound theological truths, that's something that's been almost forgotten by the churches, and therefore by extension even more so by those of us who are not in the churches.
For a Swede like myself, you know, Luther is of course someone we tend to come back to every time we try to explain Swedish work ethics or why we're so incredibly boring as a people. But it's also interesting to see, you know, the difference between Catholic culture and Protestant culture is often used as explanations for everything from tensions within the EU to fiscal policy. And I wonder, have these cultural differences any explanatory power in the response throughout Europe to the COVID crisis?
I think it's complicated by the fact that even the Catholic Church has become pretty Protestant.
Okay.
By which I mean that the importance of conscience, the idea that it's up to the individual to decide what is right, that, in other words, the individual has a kind of direct link to a sense of what is right and wrong, is something that ultimately is what has bred the individualistic quality of the West, the sense that we're all kind of autonomous. And I think that this is one of the reasons why the Western response to COVID has been less effective, perhaps, than, say, in China or in Korea, is that although people have in general behaved well and we've all knuckled down and here we are recording this in our houses, there is a feeling that we're not prepared to sacrifice our individuality to the degree that perhaps might serve to absolutely wipe this virus out. And that, I think, again, is a consequence of the way in which the Protestant Reformation in turn fed into the Enlightenment, fed into various traditions that have continued to reverberate through and then received another great convulsive spasm of reformatio with the 60s, which in a sense pushed this to such limits that it's almost impossible to recognise it as being Christian at all. And that's essentially where we are at the moment. There's a kind of tension between the sense of responsibility that we have, you know, enduring sense of ourselves as societies, but this profound sense of individualism is coexisting with it. And that's the kind of cause. And I think that seems to be a source of tension within Catholic countries as much as within Protestant countries.
Going back to your essay, one thing that stayed with me is that you write that the memories of this pandemic will not quickly fade, and that it will leave permanent scarring on the mind. Could you expand on that? And in what way do you believe this pandemic will change us, if it will?
I think that it will lead to a fear of the global. I think the sense that this was spread by too many people on too many planes, flying too fast and too quickly, will stay with us. I think the sense that it was brought under control by shutting airports, by closing borders, will remain with us. I think that there will be an anxiety about China that will not go away quickly. I think that all of these will kind of remain as part of the collective subconscious for quite a while. I think it will fuel an anxiety about where 21st century capitalism is heading, because I think it reinforces narratives about global warming. I think that people will interpret the impact that COVID-19 has had as a kind of compressed version of what global warming may hold for the world. So I think it will serve as a pretty profound spur to environmental activism, all of which I think will have a knock-on effect on the kind of liberalised, globalised capitalism that, you know, certainly I've pretty much taken for granted, that everyone takes for granted, that's provided the motor for economic growth and therefore the reduction of poverty around the world. So I think that a lot of assumptions will be questioned. However, having said that, I think it's equally possible that these will just remain as kind of distant trace scarrings on the lungs, and people will continue to breathe, and there'll be plenty of times where we don't even remember them. Because I think if you look at the literature of pandemic and how people have written about it, what you actually notice, people haven't actually written about it very much at all. You know, there's very, very little about the Spanish flu. There's even very little, you know, about the Black Death. And so I end the essay with a third walk, which is to the Tabard Inn in Southwark in London, which is where Chaucer meets up with the company of pilgrims in the Canterbury Tales, his great late 14th century poem. And the pilgrims then head off to Canterbury. And I must have read the general prologue, the opening to that poem, many, many times, because Chaucer is meeting up with his fellow pilgrims in April, so after winter. And winter is the time when disease is most endemic. He's meeting up in London. Cities, as ever, are the place where plague and sickness are most intense. And what he does is to meet up with a group of strangers in a pub, and then to go out, leave the city, to head out into the open countryside. And these are all the things that over the past months we in London have been unable to do. And so suddenly you realise that you can't take these things for granted. And suddenly you realise what's going on here, that these are things that you can't do during an outbreak of plague. And by the time Chaucer is writing this, plague is endemic. It's happening all the time. So the fact he can do it shows that he's setting it in a period where plague is not happening.
Yeah.
And it's great. And you go out and you drink and you meet strangers and you tell stories and you go out on the road and you have fun. A pilgrimage is the closest that you get in the 14th century to going on holiday. So it's like meeting up in an airport with a load of making friends in the airport, sharing a drink, getting on a plane, going to a seaside resort. And it's suddenly brilliant. That's probably, I think, what life will be like. There will be this scarring on, you know, on the lung, but by and large, I suspect that people will get back to it, and probably we won't have any great COVID literature.
and we will remain to be human beings. But Tom, what is the first thing you will do when lockdown ends?
I will go and play cricket.
Tom Holland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation, production by Nick Hilton.